Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I am your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Paula McQuaid. Paula is Professor of English at DePaul University in Chicago, and she is the author of Catechisms and Women's Writing in 17th Century England, recently published by Cambridge University Press. Paula, congratulations on the book, and welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Crawford. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to talk to you. Before we talk about the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, perhaps how you got to where you are in terms of your career and what the background to the book is?
Yes, thank you. I, as you mentioned, I'm in a Department of English Literature. And so my dissertation written a while ago was actually on Renaissance drama. So quite different. I worked on religion and Renaissance drama, but still sort of more interested in traditionary literary forms. I'm fortunate to be at a university where I was able to get tenure fairly early in my career and fairly easily. At that time, we don't have, like they have in England, exorbitant research requirements every year. And so what that did actually is it gave me freedom to pursue what I was really interested in and freedom to sort of think outside the box a little bit of think up outside disciplinary boxes. So I moved away from the focus on drama, sort of follow my true interest, which was sort of early women's writing, but also more broadly religious writing and religious thought in the period. So it's a sort of happy story of freedom, institutional freedom, allowing me to pursue interests that I really love.
It's funny you mentioned institutional freedom, because many people would not associate the form of the catechism with that particular theme. So how did you come to think about catechisms?
That is actually a very personal... It has a very personal beginning in that. So after I received tenure, I had 3 children in 4 years and very, very busy time. And one of the things that occurred to me, so I would be reading to my children at night and I was really sort of blown away. I came to motherhood slightly late and I was blown away about how it was nothing like I had come to expect. I mean, I had such joy and pleasure and I experienced such love in reading to my children and teaching them how to read. And it just occurred to me, it's really that very personal experience, that none of that was reflected in the literature on early modern women as writers and early modern women as mothers and as teachers. So I thought, well, it can't be true, you know, that early modern women didn't also enjoy and sort of benefit from this experience. And so it's really that intensely personal sort of realization that sparked my interest in recovering this body of work.
That's fascinating. Now, Paul, you mentioned there dominant themes or the consensus within the scholarship surrounding mm-hmm. early modern women's writing. It's a relatively new field, isn't it? And maybe in the last, 30, 40 years?
Yes.
Recovery of interest in early modern women. How has this field developed? Why did it start? How has it developed over time? And do you have any sense as to where it is today?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. So I was fortunate to be at the sort of, when I was in graduate school, so my first year in sort of graduate school was when the field was taking off. And the early field was very much dominated. It very much reflects the sort of first wave feminism that it emerged from. So the concern then was on finding a history of early modern women writers in literary genres. So you were interested in finding women poets and women playwrights. And then also there was a definite interest in finding women whose work was somehow subversive, right? Subverted patriarchy, fought the power. And that sort of played itself out for, I would say, from 1990 to sort of about 2000. But it's still, especially the concern, so the concern with literary genres has, I would say, in the past 15 years in the field, begun to lessen. There's been a lot of great work on women's writing and manuscript and sort of thinking about the difference between manuscript and more literary form, or manuscript and print. And there's been more attention sort of paid to sort of generic diversity. What has still lasted, I think, is a concern with women, finding women who were either subversive, and then there's also a focus that's linked with that. If they're not subversive, then you want women who are sort of in powerful positions. So you want women, you know, Catherine Parr, Queen Elizabeth. And I mean, and that's all wonderful work. It's just my feeling as the book evolved was, I say in the epilogue that one of the things basically I've tried to do is to resurrect or refigure a genre that's been hidden, a genre of women's writing that's been hidden in plain sight. It was always there. It's just because of the way the discipline was constructed, no one was interested in looking at non-elite women who wrote in non-literary forms and who seemed to be happy mothers at the same time. It just, no one was interested in it, but the texts were readily available.
It's striking that you use the word finding so much in that last answer, Paula, because so much of the work that continues in this field is still about that basic discovery, isn't it? It's a kind of an archaeology, a kind of unpicking or uncovering of these forgotten voices.
Yes.
So you're based in the literature department.
I am.
But you're finding catechisms as a way of releasing or uncovering or rescuing a very important early modern woman's voice. Why catechisms? What is this literary form? For anyone who's not familiar with it.
So catechisms are, they also have a bad rap because of, so let me just answer the question directly. It's a form, question and answer. And in the manuscripts or the books, the printed texts that we have, they can range from the quite simple. So they might open, you know, what is God? God is a spirit. He is unknowable. Etc. And so there's a basic catechism known as the ABC with the catechism. Shakespeare learned to read from this. And it's a sort of simple way of presenting Christian doctrine in question and answer forms. The parent or the minister would ask the question and then the child would repeat the sort of... In its basic form, the child would then repeat the memorized answer. But what's actually true about catechisms is catechisms are quite varied, actually. So you have basic catechisms like the ABC with the catechism, and even more simple ones designed for sort of very early children, 4, 5, 6. But then as a form, you also have intermediate catechisms, which might be on questions about the nature of God. And then you'll have advanced question catechisms, you know, what is the nature of the beatific vision? Or how can we be sure, you know, on what basis can our assurance be determined? So it's a variety of forms, both in terms of the questions that are asked, the content that is covered. And then finally, and if your readers or listeners are interested, Pilgrim's Progress actually has a very interesting dialogue when Prudence questions Christian's wife, Christiana. She asks to question the children on their how they've been taught. She sort of goes through and gives a sort of gradated forms of the catechism. She asks the youngest child very simple questions, and then the oldest child gets questions about sort of the nature of the resurrection. So it gives a sense of what early modern practice, the variety of early modern practice. In catechesis. The second thing I would say is that catechisms were in their design, memorization was the first step. There are a lot of manuals beginning in the early 17th century, which are designed to help families, I mean, this is family religion, help families sort of teach their children. And what you see there is you see a lot of sort of the minister, oftentimes it's a local minister, sort of trying to teach what we would call critical thinking to the parents. Well, if you ask, what is the nature of God? Then you ask, how do you know that? And then the child's expected to find the biblical verse. So it's actually a very comprehensive educational program for people who wouldn't have had the benefit of an advanced education in schools. So it's home-based education in that sense, at sometimes quite a sophisticated level. And the final thing I would say, Crawford, is that there are many manuscripts, and this is another area which still needs to be tapped, many, many manuscripts in which we have parents who have written in the manuscripts of the catechism, and they are enacting what they have been told to do. They are enacting this product, this process of critical thinking. So they will say, you know, they'll have a question and they'll write in the margins, how do you know this? Or important, you know, what is the biblical verse? Find a biblical verse. So we have evidence that they are in fact trying to put these ministerial injunctions about how to conduct their domestic catechesis into practice.
Now, you used there, Paula, the word enacting, and you've described catechisms as a kind of scripted speech. Is there a way in which we can equate these texts to dramatic texts?
Yes, I think very much. And I think as anyone who has been in, I think the analogy, it's more than an analogy. I mean, it's actually, I think it's very much how they were performed in a household. You would have, and just as if you've been in a performance, there's a great variety of room for improvisation, for sort of response. I think it's very much that. And I think a lot of the joy that you get from a performance, from a communal performance of a play, is a lot of what you're looking at when you get accounts of catechesis. Oftentimes, if you look at the early modern record, you will get people saying much joy, much comfort, much pleasure. I don't think they use the word pleasure, much comfort from this lesson that we had. So I think it was very enjoyable, perhaps very lively. And it was also a time, you know, in a performance, just like in a play performance, you get sort of, there are moments of moving off script and the attention of giving one person giving actual attention to the other. And I think that's also a lot of enjoyment from it in this dialogue, the sort of attention that you pay to the other person. There's also, I should say, evidence in catechisms of its oral performance. So you'll have, there's written textual sort of print evidence where the mother will say, speak it high and in a loud voice, you know, or be clear. Or you have evidence, even in print catechisms, you have evidence of, you know, and they'll talk about the creed seated at the right hand of the God, and the mother will say, of God. The mother will say, what is meant by God's right hand? And the child's supposed to say, it's spoken for our capacity. You know, I mean, so there's a lot of sort of moments in which you can, I think what you're talking about there, Crawford, are textual markers of an oral performance. And so just like in a play script, you see textual residue. It's a textual remnant of an oral performance. I think that's exactly what you have in a catechism as well.
Now, your book really brings this to life with energy and vivacity. Tell us about the character of household religion then. What was it like to be in a situation where these texts were being memorized or used or performed? And also, what does your study tell us about the role of women, household religion, in this period?
I think household religion, and I know there is a considerable and growing body of work on it. We have not plumbed its depths. I think for Protestants, especially the hotter sort of Protestants, I think what we as moderns have a hard time understanding about it is that it was immensely pleasurable, immensely joyful, and a source because the joy stems from directing your will towards the study of something, the ultimate good, right? But also communal intellectual activity, communal study, and communal, again, I think your analogy of a play rehearsal is excellent, communal performance. Yeah, the attention in a world which, as much as one can recreate, probably like our own, had many demands upon, you know, parental attention. It was a time in which parents enacted with their children and interacted with their children in a sort of in an intense basis. And I think that was incredibly important. So I think household religion has been studied, but could even benefit from more study. But also because, as you mentioned, the importance of women. Women played a crucial role in household education. The dictum, the Pauline injunction, which prevents women from speaking in church, did not apply to women's role in the household. And so women had a great deal of freedom and responsibility and what we would call empowerment as educators within the household. They were responsible for teaching their child how to read in many cases. They were responsible for teaching them the basis of the Christian faith and for continuing that education. So I think if we're really interested, and so the catechisms that I talk about in the book are all examples of women who either, there's some examples like you mentioned, Catherine Thomas, where she records both. I mean, she's a great example. She's a woman who lives in a little village on the Welsh border. And she's got Miss Lenny, and she's got two catechisms in there. One, probably she used to educate her children. And it's very... it's the best. So you've got questions. It's written probably, it's the sort of type of catechism written for people between the age of 10 and 13. And there are all sorts of questions designed to appeal to a child's love of comparisons, right? So they'll say, who was the strongest man, right? Who was the weakest man? How many children did Elijah or died because they called Elijah a bald head, you know, questions that who was the strongest man? Questions that are designed to appeal to children and also test their biblical knowledge. You have that. And then what you have in the same book, you have a catechism that she wrote based upon, she was a Church of England Protestant, but she used the catechetical form to, record her engagement with a Catholic devotional book. So it's a capacious genre that what you see in that manuscript, I would argue, is both the sort of importance of catechesis within the household and as mothers educating their children, and then the way in which mothers could use that education and use that experience to sort of as a vehicle for authorship, to sort of become authors in their own right and engage with other works.
So it's fun. It's a fun time. There's quizzes, as in Catherine Thomas' catechism. But it's also a deeply serious moment of reflection and teaching as well. And one of the ways in which we can see the seriousness of that, as your book shows so well, is that these women, or many of these women, are not content with the available printed catechisms, but want to compose their own.
Mm-hmm. So
these women are writers, but these women are theologians as well. Where are they getting their theological ideas from?
That was one of, I don't want to say the surprises, but one of the lessons, I think, of the study is how theologically sophisticated many of these women were. I think there's the two most, I think, theologically sophisticated. Lady Catherine Fitzwilliam, who's related to Grace Mildmay, and her husband was at court in the sort of evangelical Protestant wing. She is a fairly sophisticated theological thinker. She writes a treatise on assurance, and it's in catechetical form. She also writes a treatise on affliction, in which she's really trying to think through, okay, how can I sort of reconcile these setbacks that I have had and my family has had with this idea of a loving God and being one of his elect. She talks about, and they're very particularized to her experience. So you can say, how do we know that, how can we endure the affliction? She talks about gout and other sort of, sicknesses. And then she'll respond, well, God gives us good friends, good doctors, soft beds. He's treating us like a physician. But you can really see her trying to use these available theological terms to sort of think through the problem of affliction. The other one who's really quite an innovative theologian, and using the catechetical form, is Mary Carey. Mary Carey was a fifth monarchist, so she's writing in the 1640s. Her first work, I believe, appears in 1648, or one of her most monumental work. And she's writing as a member of the fifth monarchist. It's been suggested that she was one of the founding members of the fifth monarchist. But she is really a person where the more I plumb her theological knowledge, the more I'm very much surprised by the depth of her reading. And let me give you one example. In the preface to the book, The Resurrection of the Witnesses, which she constructs so that it has catechisms within it. I mean, I think it's very interesting. You see, like these other writers, the book is not a catechism entirely, but it has many inset catechisms. So again, speaking from a literary sense, you can see her as consciously playing with the form. But she has a preface when she says, I'm not writing as a prophet. I say I have no direct inspiration from God. I'm writing as, you know, my own sort of expositor of revelation of scripture. And why that's significant is she recognizes that the sort of one way in which women were normally sort of encouraged to speak within a congregation was if they were prophets, right? Because then the idea is a prophet isn't bound by the normal prescriptions against female speech because God is inspiring the prophet, and God, you know, doesn't care who the vessel is. God will speak where God wants to speak. But she explicitly denies that and claims authority as a sort of independent exegete. So I think what you see there is a sort of a depth of knowledge. And then she mentions biblical women. And the interesting thing, the person who keeps coming up in many of these discussions about women and catechesis, because catechesis is really about teaching, is Mary Magdalene. And both Mary Carey and Catherine Thomas, the woman who lives on the Welsh border, are very interested in Mary Magdalene as a sort of resurrection witness, and perhaps as the first resurrection witness. And resurrection witnesses were also gospel witnesses who were, you know, in the account in Mark, they say, go and tell the other apostles what I have told you. And so they're very interested in seeing her as a figure, as a teacher, who has not prophetically inspired.
I think this is one of the things about your book that really struck me, is the way in which it opens up, the extent to which many of these early modern new religious movements, so we might use that terminology, were actually very open to women's voices. Now, you mentioned the fifth monarchist there, Paula. Could you just remind us who they were? If we know anything about them, it may just be their attempted coups in the early 1660s, but there's a kind of a theological depth behind them as well, along with these sometimes extraordinary prophetic claims they wanted to make.
It is. And this is something that I'm increasingly interested in, the fifth monarchists. I actually, in the case of Carey, the person I know the best who's a fifth monarchist. So let me give you the sort of overview first. They were a group that, a Civil War group developed during the Civil War. And they're often talked about in relationship to the Levelers, because they had a sort of program for social reform. They wanted to make universities free. They wanted the famous example of Mary Carey. She wants to develop a postal system and then use the taxes to sort of pay ministers. They want to get rid of tithes. They want to help the poor, right? So many of their concerns dovetail with other sort of more political movements during the Civil War. But they were not exclusively a political movement. What they were was they had a belief in the sort of that biblical history based on the reading of Revelation and Daniel, that biblical history could be divided into sort of five monarchies. And they believe that the fifth monarchy would inaugurate the reign of King Jesus. And that would inaugurate a 1,000-year rule, after which would sort of be this version of the end of the end times. But there was, as much as I can discern, a participatory eschatology. So that means that they believed that they had to sort of enact these social reforms to sort of prepare the sort of beginning reign of King Jesus, who would then come and rule. So that's the background for the movement. What I found with my work with Mary Carey is they're very much coming out of a domestic religion environment. Many of them, in fact, most of them are not formally trained theologians. Carrie mentions that her own training, it's very, very interesting. Her own training happened when she was 16 and her mom, she was evidently living with her mom, had a revelation. And so Carrie began to study intensely the books of Revelation and Daniel. So it's her, she cites home-based training. And through a lot of these people who are associated with the Fifth Monarchists, they're either citing home-based training or they're citing community, church-based sort of communal scriptural study as the basis for their theology. So, but, and the only thing I would add to that, which I think was implicit in your question, is that, they're really quite energetic and smart. They're not, so, and you see this best with Carrie. I don't know if you've read Carrie or any of the listeners have read Carrie, but she's both incredibly rewarding and incredibly frustrating because she isn't, as a person who's not formally trained, it's not a very disciplined presentation. At the same time, she's incredibly smart and she knows a great deal. There's a lot of study which underlies her sort of reading. So I think she rewards, and she's someone who I would just say, the more you probe with her, the more you look, oh, I don't know how she knows that, right? Or how does she get that? So she's actually quite, I think, sophisticated. She has quite extensive scriptural and theological knowledge.
Now, is it true to say that Mary Carey, I was really struck by your chapter on Carey, but is it true to say that Mary Carey is not writing specifically for children in her catechism?
No, she's not. Thank you. And that's an excellent point. One of the things I try to say in the book, or one of the things I'm interested in, is that catechisms began as a form, right, through which it's this sort of licensed or allowed way for women to think through and think about and teach religion and religious doctrine. And what you see is, oh, especially over the course of the 17th century, what you see is women are increasingly using that training, that home-based training, to sort of venture into sort of religious and political controversies, right? So they're taking something that they're allowed to do, that they have experience and sort of confidence in doing, and then it's giving them the confidence to sort of venture into areas in which women weren't supposed to venture at all. I mentioned Dorothy Birch earlier. She publishes her catechism because she disagrees with the local royalist Laudian minister, you know, so she's intervening in sort of a debate happening in 1640s, almost over by the 1640s, about the extent to which the people can be knowledgeable expositors of scripture. And she publishes her catechism as a way of sort of responding to this male minister. Carrie takes the catechetical form and uses it as the basis, as you suggest, to make this really sort of profound and far-reaching sort of intervention in contemporary religious discussion. I mean, a lot of people are discussing Revelation in the late 1640s, as you know, and she's right in there. And she sees her catechetical training as sort of providing the basis for her to do that. You know, and I think some ministers, so and interestingly with Carrie, she's the only one of the catechists I discuss who was actually responded to in print. It's an anonymous response, but it seems like it was written by a sort of mainstream theologian. And his response to her is interesting because he does sort of in passing say, oh, this woman minister, you know, who does she think she is? But the majority of his attack or of his is against her not being educated properly, right? It's against her using this home-based training to sort of tackle these questions. She doesn't have the proper training to talk about these things. And one of the, he focuses on the fact that she transposes a date incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And he says that's evidence of the orality of her training and she's not trained, you know, sort of properly. Therefore, she has no basis to speak. So it's an interesting moment in which they are precisely sort of foregrounding. I mean, that response foregrounds the extent to which the minister is recognizing that this home-based training has encouraged people to speak in a public forum and trying to sort of clamp it down.
So catechism designed to undergird religious consensus actually ends up undermining it in some remarkable ways.
I think that's true.
It's a fascinating book, Paula. We could talk for ages about it, and hopefully we'll get another chance to do that sometime. But for now, let me say thanks. It's been great to talk to you about the book. Before we wind up, could you tell us what you hope to work on next?
Well, I am increasingly interested. I have two possible projects, but probably what I'm going to do, as you can probably tell from my previous response, I'm increasingly interested in the Fifth Monarchists. And what I'm particularly interested in them is there's a lot of work being done within women's writing and the scholarship on women's writing about sort of, okay, you mentioned earlier, Crawford, the work of recovery, right? And there's a lot of sort of self reflection within the community of people who work on women's writers about sort of, have we recovered everybody that there is to recover? And then there's also at the same time this idea that, you know, I don't know if you saw, there was an article in TLS sort of saying women's writing has sort of settled for this sort of in an exclusive focus on women as separate from men. We have sort of ghettoized ourselves so that we can't speak and participate within sort of mainstream discussions. And so one of the things I'm interested in working on the Fifth Monarchists is, as you mentioned, I think, it is a movement which was incredibly open to women. You have Mary Carey, but then you also have a female prophet, and I like to think of her as a performance artist, Anna Trapnell, who's giving prophecies from her bedroom that are very influential. With people like Vavasor Powell and sort of in the London sort of underground, if you will. And I'm interested, but they are joined by and they are participating with all these other really interesting people. I mean, the other thing about the Fifth Monarchists, which I didn't mention, is that they're very interested in the question of Judaism and sort of going back to sort of early pre-Platonized Christianity, right? So you see a lot of people sort of learning Hebrew, trying to get back to that. But there are also always these people who are kind of on the margins. These are not sort of elite people. So you have women and you have sort of not really well-educated or only partially educated men who are interested in this, who are nonetheless engaged in asking these very important scriptural and religious questions. So in the next book, what I'd like to do is sort of think about both the role of women in the movement without sort of necessarily, I mean, my working hypothesis is, you know, what if they were just members of the movement, right? Yeah. What if they weren't singled out because of their gender? What if they just, I mean, and there were moments, of course, where gender becomes important and to talk about those, but not necessarily, maybe that wasn't the most important aspect of their participation. So just to think through those sort of questions.
Fascinating. Well, I really can't wait to see that, Paula, when it comes out.
Listen, thank you.
Thanks for your time today. Thanks for coming onto the show and talking about this wonderful book, Catechisms and Women's Writing in 17th Century England, recently published by Cambridge University Press. Thanks for your time and take care.
Oh, thank you, Crawford. Lovely talking to you.
And you too. And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.